Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, September 22nd. I'm Ray Graff. Support comes from Stinging Nettle Botanics, Main Street, Catskill, New York, offering handcrafted organic herb-based products, incorporating natural herbal remedies into daily life. StingingNettleNY.com. Today we welcome Dr. David Chismark, a colon and rectal surgeon at Albany Med, where he uses traditionally and minimally invasive procedures to treat benign and malignant disorders of the colon and rectum, including cancer, diverticulitis, inflammatory bowel disease, rectal bleeding, hemorrhoids, fecal incontinence, constipation, and many other conditions. The number to call if you have a question for Dr. Chismark is 1-800-348-2551, or you can email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. David Chismark and your calls coming up. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. In the studio for this Medical Monday is Dr. David Chismark. Dr. Chismark is a colon and rectal surgeon at Albany Med, where he uses traditional and minimally invasive procedures to treat benign and malignant disorders of the colon and rectum, including cancer, diverticulitis, inflammatory bowel disease, rectal bleeding, hemorrhoids, perianal infections, anal fissure, fecal incontinence, and constipation. Board certified in colon and rectal surgery and in general surgery, he completed fellowship training at Orlando Regional Medical Center in Florida and residency training at Albany Med. He earned his medical degree from the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth. If you want to be a part of the show today, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. David Chismark, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Really great that you could make the time today.
How do you do it?
You're a fairly young man, so I don't know if you can answer this question in full context, but how is the technology, and we have a lot of calls already, so we'll get to them shortly, but how is this new technology that allows for minimally invasive procedures changed your line of work?
I think the biggest change is just that people spend far less time in the hospital and getting home, getting back to your own bed, your own family, your own food is, I think, a huge advantage and a huge benefit to recovery.
What's the most common malady that you deal with?
I'd say truly the greatest number of patients that I see are in that sort of proctology sphere of you know, problems with the backside, you know, my hemorrhoids or whatever.
Hemorrhoids as such.
I will say people come in and tell me their hemorrhoids are getting them in trouble. About half the time it's something else. So we spend a lot of time sort of figuring that out. But that's the greatest volume of folks that I see in the office. And then in the operating room, it's more, the colon resections for either benign or malignant disease.
Now, is the incidence of malignant cancer increasing?
No, that's the short version. What has happened in the last 10 or so years is we've seen an increase in the frequency of more aggressive cancers, especially rectal cancers, in young people that were thought to be at relatively low risk.
And why do you think that is?
Great question. If I knew that, I would be patting my Nobel Prize as we sat here. So we're working on that's been being looked at, whether it's environmental, whether it's other factors. We don't know, but I've definitely seen that incidence increase.
Is it diet?
Well, that's always a question. That's obviously a thing that changes, you know, region to region and with time. So that's certainly on the list of highly suspected factors.
When someone comes in for a malignant disorder that hasn't been caught, maybe stage 3, stage 4, what's the outlook for a patient like that?
Well, I think between those two you mentioned, stage 3
it's
and stage 4. So
jump.
Stage 4 is typically when, unfortunately, the cancer has spread outside its site of origin. And, you know, for the vast majority of people that have stage 4 colon and rectal cancer, we have, in many cases, lost the ability to cure that person. So it becomes a matter of managing symptoms. And then if it's their goal to sustain their life as long as possible. So that's in where we work closely with the folks in oncology to try to do both of those things.
Now, when we talk about, and we'll go back to my first question, a minimally invasive procedure,
mm-hmm.
we've talked about this in different parts of surgical medicine on this program for a long time. When we're talking about colorectal surgery, what minimally invasive procedures are we talking about?
So essentially, we're talking primarily about what we'd consider laparoscopic assisted surgery. So small incisions for a camera and for instruments, doing all the operating sort of on the inside of the body cavity, watching on a video monitor. Now, whether you do that by holding the camera and the instruments yourself or whether you employ a device, what we call a robot, to hold those instruments and camera for you, it's the same principle. And so that's the primary modality that we use for minimally invasive. You could also consider certain endoscopic procedures, so colonoscopic procedures or other, you know, endoluminal procedures where we're working inside the bowel lumen as minimally invasive. We do that a little less often, but we do that as well.
You know, you talk about minimally invasive procedures shortening the hospital stay for patients. And again, I've asked this question before, but in your line of work and in your specialty, does it improve outcomes?
It depends on what you're asking. So from a cancer standpoint,
No.
It's the same. From the standpoint of certain other long-term problems, you know, for example, hernias are less common in minimally invasive surgery. Infections are less common in minimally invasive surgery. Pain is generally less, which I think many people would agree is a pretty strong outcome improvement. So in those ways, yes, those outcomes are improved. We spend a lot of time trying to prove to ourselves, and I say we, the medical community, that minimally invasive techniques didn't make anything worse. And that's been pretty well established.
We're joined today by Dr. David Chismark from Albany Med. Dr. Chismark is a colon and rectal surgeon. The number to call is 800-348-2551. And we'll get to the call shortly, 800-348-2551. You may also email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. Jay in Albany wrote in, embarrassing question, but I think I have a good-sized tissue tag or maybe a remnant of an old pregnancy hemorrhoid. The baby's now 45. Anyway, it has been a nuisance for 45 years. Honestly, it makes cleanup complicated. Could it be removed, or is it something I have to continue to manage? And that is from Jay in Albany.
So, Jay, appreciate that. You're right. These are oftentimes things that people are a little reluctant to bring up. So it's got to start, and as I'll probably start multiple times today, this needs to be evaluated and examined and checked before anybody can tell you exactly what to do.
Right.
Having said that, if your assessment is correct that this is a residual tag from an old hemorrhoid, which we see quite a bit of, removal is something that is certainly feasible and in some cases, fairly straightforward. There's always some pros and cons to those, and we discuss risks and benefits a lot, but certainly worth getting checked, I would say, and then having somebody help you decide.
800-348-2551. You want to take a call before the first break?
Sure, let's do it.
All right, let's do this thing. We'll start with Angela in Albany. Angela, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Angela.
Thanks for calling. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, 5 years ago, I had a colonoscopy, and I noticed that many of us, including myself, had three polyps. Is that normal? Is that average? I mean, there were quite a few. I thought that was a bit odd. And a few years before that, something similar. So I wanted to know if that's normal. And I also, I have IBS and diverticulitis. Well, Losis is not inflamed right now. And what's the best dietary advice? Thank you.
All right. Thanks, two for Angela. One. I love it. So thank you, Angela, for the call. And so let me answer your first question first. Three polyps is, I would say, it's hard to give you an average number of polyps, but that's a very reasonable, very common number that we would see. You know, a couple of polyps, three polyps, such that if they were all benign polyps, you would still be in that 5-year interval, recommendation. And it's a little hard to know. Some polyps are benign. Some polyps are really inconsequential, and we treat them a little bit differently. But three is a number that I would not be overly concerned about. That's a number that we see quite a bit. As to your other question about the diverticular disease, I think that's a great question and one that comes up all the time. And so the first thing I'll say is the single best recommendation I can give you is to increase your fiber intake. So that means high fiber diet, lots of greens, lots of grains, lots of fresh fruit and vegetables, and consider using a fiber supplement that you might get over the counter in your local grocery store to add more bulk to your diet. The last thing I'll say quickly is that the idea that you have to refrain from anything in particular and diverticular disease has been well disproven. So if you've been holding off on corn on the cob or seeds or nuts,
yes,
please go for it. Enjoy. Those are good, healthy options.
Angela, thanks for the call. Now, explain briefly, we have to take a break here in a minute and a half, but what is a polyp? And do we all have them?
No. So polyp is basically a benign tumor. It's a tumor that grows from the lining of the colon, and it is in some cases the precursor lesion for an invasive cancer. So they're not normal. They are abnormal growths. Think of the colon as, you know, it is what it is. It's the septic system for our body. It sees all of our waste, all the toxins. And so we see a lot of this abnormal growth happening in the colon. So we see colon polyps much more often than we see precancerous growths elsewhere, and that's why we know we have to screen for them and take them out when we find them.
And you might not be able to answer this question exactly, but what percentage of folks who have polyps then end up with cancer?
Yeah, difficult to answer because we don't let people have rare polyps and just keep them.
You
right?
don't leave them there even if they're benign?
No, because there's no way to know they're benign until we've removed them.
Ah.
So they all get in this day and age, you know, if you're getting screened and you're getting checked, you're getting your polyps removed. To know that answer, we'd have to have a bunch of people that we leave their polyps alone and see how many of them develop cancer. The presumption is that would be a highly unethical
okay.
thing to do.
All right, so the Hippocratic Oath and everything comes. All right, fair enough. Let's take a break here. Dr. David Chismark is with us from Albany Med. We are just getting underway. 800-348-2551. Back in a flash. Pretty funky music for a show on colorectal surgery. There's Reuben Wilson, yes, sir, here on Vox Pop Medical Monday. Hey, the lockbox is open. We're doing fantastically well. You're really stepping up. The fund drive starts October 6th. That's 14 days away. And already we're closing in, we're not there yet, but on $400,000 in the lockbox. If everybody steps up who hasn't done it yet and throws a few bucks in, maybe there's no fund drive. I mean, it's not likely, but it's possible. WAMC.org is the place to make your secure online pledge. And with that, the sermon is over for now. But you'll hear from us again on the topic. Dr. David Chismark is our guest from Albany Med. Dr. Chismark is a colon and rectal surgeon. And having fun so far?
Absolutely.
All right, let's go back to the phones, and we'll go to Fred in Latham. Fred, you're on.
Hello. I am 77. I'm in good health. My grandfather had colon cancer. My father had colon cancer.
Hey, Fred, can I stop you for a minute, buddy? Fred.
Yes.
You're sounding a little muffled. Are you on a speakerphone? I'm having trouble hearing you.
Yeah, I'll take it off.
Okay, that would be great. Zach, the engineer, thanks you. That's wonderful. Okay, go ahead.
Hello?
Yep.
We're here.
Go ahead. You're there, Fred. Go. Talk, baby. Talk. He hung up. Well, I guess I was impertinent to ask him to get off his speaker. Hey, folks, couple things, and I don't say this enough. This is on me. If possible, not always, but if it's possible, use the handset. Sounds much clearer. And the other thing is turn your radio down when you get on the air. My fault, negligent host. I don't say it every day, but please do. Fred, we hope you call back. Let's go to Orange. Barbara, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
Thanks for calling.
I was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer 2.5 years ago, and I had chemotherapy, radiation, and the Whipple, and I'm on the cure list. And
congratulations.
Thank you. I'm very in very good health, but I have diverticulosis. When I had my colonoscopy when I was 65, they said I had the colon of a 20-year-old, and I'm not exactly sure what that meant. But I didn't have any polyps, and it was good. But I'm very curious now because of the radiation. I'm wondering what the effects of the radiation might be long term. And I always eat a high fiber diet, but I love red meat, and everybody tells me all these things I shouldn't eat and not eat. But my surgeon told me I could eat whatever I wanted,
which sounds weird. Sounds like you had a good surgeon. So, you know, radiation is an incredibly useful tool that provides great stories like yours all the time about cure. and treatment of malignancies. It does have side effects, and it does have effects on non-target tissue, so other tissues besides what the tumor that's being treated. But the good news is the radiation oncologists seemingly are getting better and better all the time at focusing their attention on the tumor and sparing surrounding tissue.
Yes, they are.
Yeah, so one...
Yes, they are. I had it at the best place you can have it. He would only do radiation at MGH.
There you go. So I think that the likely effects of your radiation are fairly minimal, and they would be effects that you could expect would be addressed during regular colorectal cancer screening, whatever modality you choose. And so I would just suggest that you keep up with your doctor and have that done regularly. As far as the diet is concerned, diet is a hard thing to know. I would never tell anybody to completely refrain from red meat, though we know that diets that are, too high, that are a little overly concentrated red meats, especially charred meats, are probably not the best for us.
Why?
Thank you. Can I ask you something else?
Sure, Barbara.
I'm sorry. This is just so important to me. So the Whipple took away a lot, changed a lot, and I eat all the time. I'm ravenously hungry, and I don't really gain much weight. And I was wondering if you might have any ideas about that.
Ooh, first of all, congratulate you that you can eat all the time and not gain weight. I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who are jealous.
One of them.
Probably has a lot to do with the metabolic changes that come with a Whipple procedure, which admittedly is not necessarily my specialty or forte, but I suspect is related to the changes that were induced both anatomically and physiologically by that procedure.
All right, Barbara, thanks a lot for the call. What's wrong with charred meat?
When you're burning those molecules, they become in some ways carcinogenic. And again, we were talking about before, everything passes through the colon. Now, it doesn't all get absorbed. It doesn't all stay, but it's exposing that tissue to those potential carcinogens.
Mm-hmm. When we were talking to Barbara, she mentioned radiation. In your line of work, you work fairly closely with radiation oncologists, right?
We do.
That technology, and I know that's not your subspecialty, but that has improved so much with the sort of not radiating organs behind what you're looking at, right? The focus of
absolutely.
That?
Absolutely.
So has that improved? How often you're a knife guy, right?
Absolutely.
All right. So how often do you then say, listen, we have to go to radiation on this?
For certain conditions, it's almost always.
Yeah.
For certain conditions, for example, anal cancer, which is a different disease than rectal or colon cancer, is treated almost exclusively by radiation and chemotherapy, and surgery is only reserved for those that fail to resolve. So there are times where we use radiation exclusively. There are times where it is a big, big component of multimodality therapy.
Our guest today is Dr. David Chismark from Albany Med. He is a colon and rectal surgeon. The number here is 800-348-2551. Or you can email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. Gene is in Delaware County. Hello, Gene. You're on.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Sure. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I have a question about whether or not the tendency toward hemorrhoids is a genetic or is composed of a genetic factor.
Great question.
In other words, is it like a venous insufficiency? Mine came due to my pregnancies, and I have to, like the woman was talking about, the cleansing part, the cleaning, the being very fastidious has been going on for all those years since I had my children.
Yeah, I thank you for the question. I appreciate that. So let me just say that, first of all, having hemorrhoids is genetic in the same way that having arms and legs is genetic, right? They're a normal part of anatomy. We all have them. We inherited all that stuff from our parents, and we all have the structures that exist in the anal canal to help seal off the anus and prevent us from leaking. It's one of our social adaptations as we evolved. So having them is genetic only in that sense. The other thing that's important to remember is that many people inherit not so much genetic traits but habits from their families, right? Their eating habits, their toileting habits, their levels of activity, and that often contributes to the development of what we would call symptomatic hemorrhoids, or hemorrhoids that become noticeable and problematic. So those are the reasons that they likely developed, and pregnancy is certainly a big part of that. as far as you know, the management of them, I think that's always something that they should be, if they're giving you trouble, we always talk about hemorrhoids are managed based on the symptoms that they cause, and if they're giving you trouble, they should be evaluated, and you should hear what the options are.
Okay, Gene. Okay, Gene is dumbfounded.
Thanks
all
for
right,
the call.
Good job. Gene, 800-348-2551. That's the number if you have a question for Dr. David Chismark. 800-348-2551. Remember Fred, who had the phone problems?
Yes, he's back.
Yeah, I thought he was miffed at us, but he wrote in.
Great.
Did the wise thing, and he emailed in. This is from Fred. Preventive questions. I'm 77 in good health, says Fred. Grandfather, father, uncle, and all had colon cancer. I have diverticulosis. I am also totally lactose intolerant. I've had colonoscopies every 3 years, usually a few benign polyps. Last colonoscopy this past May was clean. The doctor felt I didn't need colonoscopies anymore, given my age. I used to have a very high-fiber diet. About 4 years ago, I began experiencing very fast transit time. I cut out coffee, soda, salad dressings, etc. The only thing that brings transit time back to normal is drastically reducing fiber intake. Aside from Imodium, can you suggest any way to increase fiber intake and slow the transit time? And that's from Fred.
That's a big question, Fred. Thank you for
your
time.
I'm glad he didn't call because it would have taken up the whole show.
First of all, I'm glad to hear that you've been fastidious about your colonoscopies. That does sound like a fairly extensive family history, and that would put you in that higher risk category. I would only suggest to you is if you are in as good health as you describe, you know, the decision to have a colonoscopy or not is not a one-sided decision. And I think if you're well enough that you would want to be treated aggressively for a, you know, colon cancer that was discovered or a polyp that was found, it may be worth talking to your doctor about whether you should have your colonoscopy. Maybe on a different timetable or a different interval than you've been doing. The 3 years, you know, may not be necessary. But, you know, there is no definitive age where we don't do colonoscopies anymore. To your question about transit time, that's a difficult one to answer because it is going to be a little bit specific. It sounds like you've found your answer, that less volume, less bulk slows your transit time, which makes some physiologic sense. The colon responds to volume, so the more you're putting in, the more stretch of those walls and the more it's going to trigger the colon to move. So you may need to drop the fiber in that way. You could certainly see if you could find the right dose. But if you're having good function, and by that I mean a tolerable frequency and you're able to evacuate comfortably, then I think I would leave it at that.
All right. And thank you for that email, Fred. The email address here is voxpop@wamc.org. The number is 800-348-2551. Fred said he had a few benign polyps, but he didn't say they were removed. Is that implicit?
Yes, I think so. Again, the only way to know they're benign truly is to have them removed. So the training for anybody who does colonoscopy, gastroenterologist or surgeons, is that if you see an abnormal growth, you remove it and send it to the pathologist.
Dr. David Chismark joins us on this edition of Medical Monday. He is a colon and rectal surgeon at Albany Med. Let's go to Germantown, and it's Franny's turn. Hello, Franny. What do you know?
Hello there. So I had a colonoscopy about a year ago, and they had two polyps removed, benign, and it turns out I have hemorrhoids inside my colon. It sometimes still hurts when I go to the bathroom. Do hemorrhoids automatically turn cancerous? I've been taking fiber, that Facilum Hus fiber from that brand Yerba Prima, since I'm in my late 20s. And I know I got the hemorrhoids from worrying. I was under a lot of stress when I was younger. So what do I need to look out for? And how does fiber help keep the colon clean?
Sure.
And disease-free?
Thank you, Franny, for those questions. So glad you're getting your colonoscopy. Glad your polyps were benign. Let's just clear something up right away. The good news for everybody that's listening is that hemorrhoids are not linked in any way to colon cancer. So having hemorrhoids, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, is a normal thing. And if your gastroenterologist tells you you have hemorrhoids in there, that's okay. What I worry about for folks is when they tell me they have symptoms related to their hemorrhoids. And if you're having some trouble with pain, again, I would suggest, you know, let somebody take a look, see if they're seeing anything other than what should be there, and then give you management options from there. As far as how fiber helps, Fiber does a couple things. It holds onto water and expands in the colon. And so it allows the colon to move material through in a more regular way. It also absorbs a lot of those toxins I mentioned earlier and lets them pass and spend less time in the colon. It also, as a third benefit, eases the actual evacuation component, and that's where the hemorrhoids can often become inflamed.
Franny.
Thank you.
You're very welcome, Franny. Thanks for calling.
800-348-2551. That's the number to call. Dr. David Chismark joins us from Albany Med. You can email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. If you wish, let's go to Ed in Salt Point. Ed, you're on.
Yes, can you hear me?
Gotcha.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
You got me?
Yep.
Okay, great.
Go ahead.
Okay, fine. The question is managing anxiety, not so much in the patient as in the patient's parents. That's us. We have a 50-year-old son, and he has had to get a colonoscopy previously, a number of years ago, and now he's up for another one. Our concern has to do with, and I'm sure he's concerned, he got hold of his doctor, and the friendly nurse there said, okay, we can schedule one for you a month out. And naturally, we are anxious. We wanted it done yesterday. And we worry about that, and you won't know other than the specific. You obviously can't jump in on a specific situation, but I wonder, you must have this concern all the time when the patient wants it done right away and, you know, there's a schedule. And then the related question is, does colon cancer skip generations or not? Particularly skip generations, because my wife's generation, the generation above her, had two or three people die of colon cancer. And so there's a concern about how it might have passed downstream to our son.
Okay.
Okay. Can you untangle all of that?
We'll do the best we can. So to your first question about timing, certainly there are lots of times where for any number of reasons, someone is anxious to get their procedure taken care of, whether they want some answers, they want some relief. So that's certainly understandable. I think that decision, though, needs to be made with some care, because obviously, we want to make decisions based on our best evidence and what we think is most likely to occur. We also want to make sure that we are not sort of using anxiety as a way to force people into the line and maybe putting other things back in the line that maybe should be getting taken care of sooner. So the short answer is your son, if he's concerned, should talk to his doctor about, what they're doing the colonoscopy for, what the concern is, what they're looking for, and whether it's appropriate to wait a month or not. I would suggest that for many things, it is a pretty reasonable time unless he's having some kind of dramatic symptom. The generational thing about colon cancer, a couple important points there. First of all, only about 25% of colon cancers are genetically linked, which means the majority of colon cancers are just sporadic. They're just unlucky. Your cells just turn the wrong way at the wrong time. And those that are genetically linked, they don't often so much skip a generation. It just depends on the inheritance pattern and what kind of genetic predisposition one has. That's a very, very difficult thing to tease out, especially when we're looking at trying to get data from a generation or two generations prior. So because of that, we generally recommend that someone with a strong family history get screened more regularly.
Ed.
Thank you.
You're very welcome, Ed. Thanks for calling.
I find this interesting. So I get your point. Going back a couple of generations, it may be tougher to get verifiable information.
Sure.
But as we move forward over the last 10, 15 years and then going into the future, what have we learned? And presumably you have a risk assessment scale of some kind when you're dealing with patients, right?
Sure.
So what have we learned about long-term genetic sort of predisposition for these things?
Well, we know a couple of things. That we know that there are two primary named and identified genetic syndromes that are highly associated with development of colon cancer. We know that there are multiple other less predictive but still important genetic changes and genetic syndromes that are, again, associated with a higher risk of colon cancer that warrant some degree of screening. But I think the same holds true. The majority of colon cancers are still sporadic in nature, and that's why we recommend screening for everybody.
Does that drive you nuts that there's so much mystery?
At times, although it is what makes it somewhat interesting at times. And you know, there's a certain amount of it's discovery that is still yet to happen.
All right. Well said. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. Dr. David Chismark is our guest today. Colorectal surgery. We'll be back in a moment. Vox Pop on WAMC, Ray Graff with you. It is a Medical Monday, and we're joined today by Dr. David Chismark of Albany Medical Center. It's colorectal surgery on this edition of Medical Monday. You probably said this during the show, but what are the age guidelines for colonoscopies nowadays?
So it's recently changed, actually, which is, you know, to your point about, you know, what we don't know. That's a recent change. So, at what we consider average risk folks, that's somebody who doesn't have a personal family history of colon cancer and does not have any symptoms, should get their first screening at 45.
Why that number?
Well, with the peak incidence of colon cancer used to be in the 60s, and it's, as I mentioned before, it's kind of sliding down. So there's the idea that we want to do colonoscopy before people have colon cancer, when they have benign polyps, because we know by removing benign polyps, we're preventing potentially a future colon cancer. So one of the few screening programs that has shown really decrease the incidence of its target cancer is colon cancer screening. Mm. So when you do it, you find these lesions early, they get removed before they become malignant, and you've cured a colon cancer before it started.
Okay. Dr. David Chismark is our guest, 800-348-2551. Let's go to Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on.
I was wondering about a lesion that starts as a subcutaneous bump and on the anal cheek and progresses to an external scab that can last for several months.
Jim, thanks for calling. And so just a real quick follow-up, does that cycle repeat itself?
It can, yeah.
Yeah. So that's, you know, the symptoms you describe, if I had to sort of make a somewhat educated guess about what that is, it does sound a little bit like what we call an anal fistula, which is an infection that can be treated and can be cured, but certainly should be checked to ensure that that's what's going on and make sure you get the proper treatment.
Okay, Jim, thanks a lot for that one. This email came in from Andrew in Fort Edward. Wondering if there's anything new about Lynch syndrome. I was diagnosed with this about 15 years ago, and that is from Andrew in Fort Edward. What is Lynch syndrome?
So Lynch syndrome, I didn't name it, but as one of the known genetic predispositions to colon cancer, among other cancers, and I'm sure this caller email question, they know that. So as far as what's new, we've changed things a little bit. There was a time where there was a bit of a push for prophylactic colectomy, so removing someone's colon before they had any diagnosis of cancer in an effort to reduce their risk. And that's still an option for people that might either be particularly concerned, have a strong family history besides their Lynch syndrome, or who just don't want the uncertainty of having their colon that they have to keep an eye on. But more often than not, we recommend an aggressive surveillance. And again, now we're not talking about screening because this is someone who has a high risk. So they'd be getting surveillance colonoscopies every 1 to 2 years.
Okay. This email from Garrett. How many is too many is the subject heading. Garrett says, this may be a TMI situation, but I personally have about 3 to 4 bowel movements a day. I eat maybe twice a day on average. Am I going too much or maybe not fully going when I do? My family has always been amazed by this, and I'm now curious, am I okay? And that's from Garrett.
So the range of normal in terms of bowel habit frequency is quite broad. So it is not inherently abnormal that you go 3 or 4 times a day, but it is also possible, as you mentioned, that you are either going in completely and not giving yourself a chance to fully evacuate. Some people have what we call sort of a little bit of constipation with some overflow where they aren't able to go because stool is so hard and packed in, but they can get some stuff to pass around it. That's entirely possible. However, if you're otherwise well, and by that I mean you're not having abdominal pain, your appetite's good, you're not having bleeding, you're not having pain with bowel movements, you know, outside of that, I think, and especially having, if you've had colonoscopies, I wouldn't be too worried.
All right. Laura writes in, high fiber and lower transit. My high fiber, low transit breakfast, 2 tablespoons chia seeds soaked for 5 minutes in 6 to 8 ounces of boiling water, and 2 tablespoons raw pumpkin seeds, and 2 tablespoons coconut yogurt. Well, it doesn't sound that tasty, but what do you think, Doc?
Good fiber. You know, chia seeds are very much like psyllium husk. They're a good source of fiber. Pumpkin seeds, same thing. Yogurt's certainly a probiotic, so that's a good thing to be in the habit of. Sounds like a pretty good move.
Okay, you're down with that. All right. By the way, just thinking about that, the seeds, you mentioned diverticulitis and sort of the myth that has been evaporated in the last 10 years.
I wish
so.
That it had been evaporated.
No, it's still around.
Very much so. That's why I wanted to mention it. It's a very commonly held belief. You know, even in folks, you know, I don't want to point any fingers, but you know, people get it from medical professionals as well.
Uh-huh. Please name names. Yeah. That'd be fun.
I can tell you. I can, you know, we can bring up the literature that shows it's not true, but it is a very firmly held belief by many people.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. It's Dr. David Chismark today, and the number is 800-348-2551. Liz is in Wineskill. Hello, Liz in Wineskill.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Sure, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for bringing awareness to this topic. I'm one of the early onset colon cancer patients that you've mentioned. And I'm stage 4. I was diagnosed when I was 33 years old. I'm 35 now and doing very, very well considering. And I was not offered surgery in the beginning, but we went for it. And Dr. Johnson at St. Peter's did my laparoscopic colectomy.
Well, Liz, I'm thrilled. No, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I was just going to say, because I know it's not available around here, I also got a hepatic pump for my liver lesions and done radiation. I'm on a clinical trial. I've done all sorts of treatments, and I wish I had done a colonoscopy earlier.
Well, Liz, thanks for calling and sharing that. That's a tough thing to be a poster child for, so I'm glad that you've gotten good treatment and you've gotten appropriate care. It's nice to hear that you got at least some of that locally. I'm glad that you had the means to get to other places to get the hepatic infusion pump. I hope that you continue to do well. And for what it's worth, I think if you know the point I'll make here from Liz is if you're having symptoms, colonoscopy is absolutely indicated regardless of age. Right, we're talking about screening. For asymptomatic, low-risk or average-risk people, if you're having symptoms, changes in bowel habits, rectal bleeding, all those kind of things, diagnostic colonoscopy, same test, different name, absolutely indicated regardless of age.
All right, Liz, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Dr. David Chismark today on this edition of Medical Monday. And let's go to Rotterdam, and it's Carol's turn. Hello, Carol.
Yes, hi, this is Carol, and I have a quick question. Actually, I knew your previous caller from a cancer group that we belong to together. But my question is, at what age can you discontinue having colonoscopies?
Oh, yeah. Carol, thank you for calling. It's a good question. And typically when somebody says it's a good question, it's because there's not a good answer. And that's unfortunately the case here. It is going to be really dependent on what your risk of colon cancer is. In other words, have you had polyps? Have you had cancer? Your family history? As well as your overall health. It's very, very easy. You know, if someone is being brought in a wheelchair from their assisted living facility, they're probably not, you know, unless they have significant risk, probably not going to have a colonoscopy. On the other hand, folks that walk in after their morning constitutional and tell me that, you know, they had their last colonoscopy 5 years ago and had some polyps and should they have another, I generally will say, you probably should. You have an increased risk and you're healthy enough that you're active and busy. We would want to know and prevent a problem, you know, down the road. So,
okay. Well, so my last colonoscopy, it was 10 years. It was clear. I had no polyps or anything. However, I am a cancer survivor with a stage 4 double hit large B-cell non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. I'm 5 years out and I'm cancer free at the moment. So I'm wondering about the colonoscopy and I'm 79.
Yeah, I think it's a conversation that I'd really suggest that you have with both your primary care physician and potentially your gastroenterologist to decide, you know, what's the risk benefit of an invasive procedure. You know, a relatively low risk one, but is certainly worth the conversation.
Okay. Well, at my last check with each of them, they both said that they didn't feel it was necessary. So I've kind of passed on it, but a little concerned also.
I think, you know, your concern is part of the equation. If it's something that you're worried about that can be reassured, that's certainly a part of the discussion.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much for your answer.
You're welcome. Good luck.
800-348-2551. Dr. David Chismark joins us from Albany Medical Center. Let's go to Orange County. Pat, you're on. Hello, Pat.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Welcome.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I was wondering if the doctor knows of any reputable colorectal surgeons in Orange County, New York.
Oh, hey, Pat, it's a dangerous thing. We're not really allowed to do that on public radio to make recommendations like that. But what if you know that there are some, you don't
well,
have...
What I think is probably better for me to tell you is ways that you can find them yourself.
Okay.
So anyone who has a distinct interest in colorectal surgery can join the National Society, the American College of Colorectal Surgery, and become a member and be listed on the website of the American Society of Colorectal Surgeons and with their practice information and their location. You can also search for people who are board certified in colorectal surgery by using the American Board of Colorectal Surgery's website and find out if there are board certified colorectal surgeons. I distinguish between the two because there are some people who may have a distinct interest in a practice that they call colorectal surgery or they do some colorectal surgery, but they may or may not be board certified. To be board certified, you have to meet certain criteria and maintain that criteria.
Right. So it would be the American Board of Colorectal...
American Board of Colon and Rectal Surgery or the American Society
colon
of Colon
and
Rectal,
rectal
Surgeons.
Surgery.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Thanks for the information.
You're very
welcome.
Thanks a lot.
So the board certification process is an ongoing one. How many
Correct.
How many years do you have to go before you have to take the test again or
yeah,
whatever it
used, is? Used to be 10.
Yeah.
That's been changed. And now it's more of a rolling process to do what they call maintenance of certification. So more frequent but smaller stakes, smaller scale exams and checkups.
Is it taxing?
I would say no.
No,
honestly, it's easier to do it on a continuous basis. At least I find it easier to do it on a continuous basis than have to take time out every 10 years and go sit somewhere and take an exam.
Now, this is not a fair question since you are in fact board certified in colon and rectal surgery, but is it a important distinction? If you're out in some spot where they don't have this, or should you be concerned and travel 300 miles for a board certified?
I would suggest that if you to get board certified, you have to do a few things. You have to complete your general surgery training and pass your general surgery boards. Mm-hmm. That's an initial hurdle. You have to complete a fellowship in colon and rectal surgery and then complete a second written and oral board exam. So the barrier has been set, not overwhelmingly high, but high enough that you have to go through the steps to do it. And I think there is a real risk of people who, for whatever any variety of reasons, don't clear those hurdles, but still want to practice in a certain way.
Okay.
There's nothing to prevent them from hanging that sign up.
Dr. David Chismark is our guest today. A couple more calls here in a moment. This email from Linda in the 845. I just wanted to make a general statement for all who suffer from diverticulitis as a result of diverticulosis. I suffered for years with infections and would sometimes get 2 or 3 bouts of diverticulitis a year, especially on vacation and when eating unfamiliar food. A year and a half ago, I had the surgery removing the last 10 inches of my sigmoid colon, and I'm so glad I did. There was some recuperation time that required rest, and in time, my bowels returned to normal. I highly recommend the surgery to anyone who might be on the fence. I have never had diverticulitis since the surgery. All right, that's from Linda in the 845. Quickly, your comment on that.
Yeah, it sounds like Linda, kind of went through that process that a lot of people go through. The surgical treatment of diverticulitis comes in two forms. One is the sort of emergency surgery when you get sick, can't wait, have to have a surgery right now, and everybody wants to avoid that. And the other form is what Linda's describing, which is to have repeated episodes of diverticulitis and eventually decide that enough is enough. The incidence of diverticulitis after that surgery should be in the single digits.
All right, let's go back to our phone lines quickly here. To Glens Falls we go, and it's Maureen. Maureen, you're on.
Thank you. My question is this. I have had strange bowel problems all my life since I was a little girl. I'm now 78. And in the last 5 or 6 years, I've had several kind of serious diverticulitis attacks. And my GP, my nephrologist, and a couple other doctors that I've seen have all said that I should have this colon resection. I had polyps in my intestine about 8 years ago, and I'm just wondering, can this be related, or should I be concerned that there may be something more there than just diverticulitis?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I would say that two things, I guess. The first thing is, if you have had repeated episodes of diverticulitis and have been advised to at least consider surgery, I would strongly encourage you to go talk to a surgeon. The good news is they're not going to take your colon out against your will, and they're not going to do it in the office. So you've got a chance to have a conversation, to hear the pros and cons, to hear the risks and benefits, to decide if it's right for you or not. The second point I'll make is that whenever someone's had diverticulitis, we typically, once they're recovered, like to consider whether we should do a colonoscopy to for the very question you're asking, to make sure that that's exactly what was going on and that there wasn't more to it, because there is a certain incidence of finding significant polyps in the setting of a recovered diverticulitis episode. Whether they're related or not, or it's coincidental, is harder to know. So I think those, again, adds to the need to have that conversation with your doctors and potentially with a surgeon to hear the risks and benefits and merits of having surgery.
All right, Maureen, thanks a lot. We're just about out of time. Dr. David Chismark, you have 15 seconds to make the case for everyone to get a colonoscopy.
15 seconds.
10 now.
If you want to significantly increase your health and your longevity, significantly reduce your risk of colon cancer, you take one evening, have diarrhea from the bowel prep, come in, have for a nap, and we'll get you taken care of.
All right, man. Hey, thanks for being on the show today. Great job.
Pleasure.
Support comes from CHP Berkshires, celebrating 50 years of commitment to caring for their community, serving more than 30,000 Berkshire residents each year. Primary care, women's health, family services, dental, and more. CHPBerkshires.org. Thanks again to Dr. David Chismark of Albany Med for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Tremendous calls, tremendous emails, much appreciated. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Bob Rathman screened the calls. Good job, Bob. I'm Ray Graff. Oh, you know, tomorrow, this will be a fun one. With the changing of the season, we welcome back our buddy, News Channel 13 meteorologist Reed Kisselback. He'll take your weather questions. We'll see you tomorrow at 2:00.